almost cut my hair. How can I sweep these words into a cluster?
One thing for sure we know is we don't know.
Welcome to the Grateful Dead Hour. This week's program features an interview with David Crosby, a legendary musician in his own right, who has also been a friend and collaborator of the Grateful Dead's for 25 years. Let's begin with a studio jam, Grateful Dead and David Crosby, recorded May 7th, 1975.
Thank you.
Grateful Dead in the studio May 7th, 1975, with David Crosby playing along. They were developing material for the album Blues for Allah, and this work in progress became known as King Solomon's Marbles. David Crosby was at the peak of his fame with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, living in Northern California near Bob Weir's house, where all the Dead were retired from touring and putting all their energy into the creation of this new studio recording. Cross hung out with the Dead quite a bit during the 60s and 70s, and in this hour you'll hear him rhapsodize about his love for the music and the people of the Grateful Dead. Let's listen to another take from that same day. Grateful Dead with David Crosby in the recording studio at Bob Weir's house, May 7th, 1975. They're working on the album Blues for Allah, and that track is called King Solomon's Marbles, and David Crosby was playing along on that version. This is the Grateful Dead Hour, and I'm David Gans. I've been a fan of David Crosby since long before I heard my first Dead tape. With the Byrds, he defined a style of music that was called folk rock and inspired a lot of what came to be known as acid rock. When I started playing the guitar in 1969, one of the songbooks I learned from cover to cover was the one for Crosby, Stills, and Nash's first album. And of course, I was mind blown by their appearance in the movie Woodstock. Crosby's first solo album, If I Could Only Remember My Name, was recorded in San Francisco in the very early 70s and featured a couple dozen of the coolest musicians around, including members of the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead. Many people believe that album is the high point of the San Francisco music scene, a generous collaboration among people who really loved each other's work. Crosby had a pretty legendary drug problem in the 80s, and it landed him in jail in Texas. While he was in the joint, I took a copy of my book Playing in the Band and got autographs from most of the Grateful Dead and their crew and several of the Jefferson Airplane family, and I sent it to Cros in prison. After he got out of jail, he opened for the Dead at the Henry J. Kaiser Auditorium on New Year's Eve 1986, and I finally got to meet him face to face.
It happened just the other day.
Last year, David Crosby nearly lost his life because of liver failure, but he was fortunate enough to receive a liver transplant, so he's still with us, which is especially cool because he and his wife Jan are expecting a child in the very near future. A few months ago, Atlantic Records released a live David Crosby album titled It's All Coming Back to Me Now. It's as live can be, recorded directly to digital audio tape at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Hollywood, December 7th, 1993. A few weeks ago, I drove to Southern California with my pal Steve Silberman, who you know from his book Skeleton Key, A Dictionary for Deadheads. Here's part of that interview in which David Crosby talks about his friendship with the Grateful Dead.
There was another name they went under first, the Warlocks or something, and I'd heard about them. I heard, man, there's some guys down there that are really out there, man. And I wanted to go and, you know, it, of course that was like honey to a bee to me. I just wanted to immediately go and find out who they were and what they did, but I didn't get to. I didn't encounter them until they were full-blown as the Dead.
And where did you see them first?
God knows, man. Probably the back of a truck and in the park or Haight Street or someplace. I don't remember.
Mm. And was it Paul Kantner who gave you their first album?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what did you think of that?
I loved it. You know, this wasn't Paul Revere and the Raiders. This was some real stuff, man. These guys were having fun, you know. And, I mean, that's my thing, man, you know. I love having fun with music, and they obviously were. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew that they were kindred spirits immediately from the first second.
Mm-hmm. When did you start playing with them?
Early on. You know, I mean, they were real nice about inviting us over. You know, when Mickey joined the band and they had the place up in Novato, I first met them when they were still living at 710. But we didn't play that time. I just hung out with them and talked and liked them a lot. And
were you living in the Haight at that
point? No. I was still living in L.A. and wanting to move north. And they helped me move north. As a matter of fact, Kid, I think, and Slade, and maybe Ram, I think, are the ones who, I think that was them, got a steak bed truck and helped me move. Up to Novato.
You moved out there with Christine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were you close to where the Dead were at that point?
Yeah, pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were seeing each other all the time because we were in the same place, and it was Slade, as a matter of fact, drove me to the hospital.
When Christine was killed?
Yeah.
And the Dead were a real support system for you at that point, huh?
Well, they're good human beings, you know. They, of course, would step in and try to help you through something like that. They're all good people, man. That's a bunch of real exceptionally good people.
Was there a lot of informal jamming going on?
Around them, always. Because they have always believed, you know, in the magic content of music, that anything is possible at any moment. That's why they always manage to keep their door open to the incredible peaks that they've, you know, sometimes hit. Now, they hit valleys, too, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. The only dependable grade of music that you can deliver every day is mediocre. And they're not interested in that anymore than I am, you know. So they leave the door open wide and take incredible chances. And as a result, they have hit musical peaks that nobody else, you know, will probably ever touch. They've also, you know, played some dog shit, mm-hmm. you know, but they know that. And they're not interested in playing dependable grade of crud, you know. They mm-hmm. want those peaks. Mm-hmm. And they keep themselves open for that. That's why they'll play with, you know, Bruce Hornsby or Branford or, you know, any of the people that they've played with, man. They want to go, they want to reach. They've always wanted to reach.
Mm-hmm. Sometime around 1970, they were moving from playing more electric, out there, acid, fiery jams from Anthem of the Sun to more folky, traditional stuff. And you and Stephen helped them learn how to sing.
Yeah, that's what they said. I think they were just being nice. They had listened to us a lot, and they realized that they liked, you know, what happened when three-part harmony went over a good track. I think they would have done it anyway. I think it's very generous of them to credit us with it, but we never sat down with them in a room and said, okay, now you sing this, now you sing this, now you sing this. That never happened. Those guys are brilliant, and they knew exactly what we were doing, and they evolved their own version of it, you know. And I think they just credited us to be nice.
Mm-hmm. But you guys were hanging out a lot.
All around the time. Then,
especially around the recording of your first solo album, If I Could Only Remember My Name.
Oh, yeah, they were. I couldn't have made that record without them. Mm-hmm. Jerry, you know, practically co-produced it. You know, he was there so many nights, man. So many nights. He gave so much of himself to that record. He was so generous. And so was everybody else, man. It was a joint project of the entire city, just about.
Yeah, that's the great thing about that record. It's like a family album.
It's a joke to call it the solo record because it was, you know, probably about 50 people made that record. But it was a wonderful thing because there were no rules. Because we had just, you know, completely grabbed the brass ring with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, I could afford to go in there every night just for laughs. And anybody that showed up, we'd try something. You know, and Paul would show up, and Grace would show up, and Nash would show up, and Neil would show up, and Jerry would show up, and Phil would show up, and Cassidy would show up, and Yorma would show up, and, you know, we would just screw around. And you know, when you screw around with that caliber of players and singers, you're going to get some shit mm-hmm. eventually, you know, mm-hmm. if you're patient. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Barnard, who engineered it all, was brilliant. You know, he would catch every scrap, and we lucked out. I still am as proud of that record as I am of anything I've ever done.
Yeah, there's a great. I think it's What Are Their Names? It's just this perfect little jam.
That's all it was. It was a jam. You can hear it. I walk in the room, start going boom, 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 boom. And then you hear Garcia walk in and start to play, and you hear Phil walk in and start to play, then you hear Michael Shreve come in and start to play, and then you know, somebody, and then you hear Neil come in or somebody. I don't know, it's like we all, you know, you can hear each guy walk in the room and pick up an instrument and start to play on this lick, you know. And then there's a gap in the lead guitar playing, which I later find out is exactly the length of this set of words that I wrote in an airplane. So I stuck them in there and invited all my pals over to sing them, gang sang these lyrics. If there was a rule that we didn't break, I don't know which one it was. Thank you.
That instrumental turned out to be Eep Hour on Jerry Garcia's first album, which was recorded in the same building at around the same time as If I Could Only Remember My Name and, incidentally, Paul Kantner's album Blows Against the Empire. This version was recorded January 11, 1971 with Paul Kantner, David Freiberg, Jack Cassidy, and I'm not sure who else. Now here's a cut from David Crosby's live album, It's All Coming Back to Me Now.
This is a brand new, hot off the press, steam still coming off it, new song. It's called Rusty in Blue. How can I sweep these words into a cluster? Put them in a pile like feathers on your floor. Voyages in the sea forest, deep blue and rusty. Sew them in a satchel and leave them at your door. People's lives, you fascinate me. All my life, all my life, I wanted to understand. There's a man on the corner, he's got the moon in his eye. He just comes here to visit, and he wears a disguise. And I wonder if he's looking for friends or for truth. I think he's calling for someone in that telephone booth. And the smiling woman answers. She defeats fear with her eyes. She thinks life's fine, so I think she's wise. And my heart wants to give her a gift so grand that it will speak for me. Just where I stand, and I stand on a pillar, and it's melting like ice. Of years that I live, and some I live twice, and I have all these feathers and leaves on my floor that I don't want just blowing round and loose anymore. And I feel a need to gather, to rummage and fetch, to shake out my life and give it a stretch, to bring shells to the surface, give them to you, gifts from the sea floor. Thank you. mention quite well. See, lives almost never run parallel. Like the boards and the flooring, all deep grained and worn, faded and faded long before we were born. People's lives fascinate me. All my life, all my life, I wanted to understand. Understand.
Thank you. Love doing that new stuff.
Hi, this is David Crosby, and for better or worse, you're listening to the Grateful Dead Hour.
This is the Grateful Dead Hour, and we're listening to Steve Silberman's interview with David Crosby.
When I was being a folky in Chicago, living on Wall Street, my friend Clem was going with this little German hooker who stood about 4 feet two or something, named the Duchess. And she was very popular on the south side of town, extremely. She was very blonde, very small, and everybody on the south side of Chicago loved this girl. And she took us down to a famous black jazz club down there called McKee's. We went in there, we sat down. Now, at that time, he had two bass players in the band, Reggie Workman and Jimmy Garrison. And he had McCoy Tyner playing piano, and he had Elvin Jones playing drums. And how they would do their set, they would get up and play a song per set. They'd first, play the song ensemble, and then Train would start off soloing. And he blew the most incredible solo, and, after he'd done it for a while, he kind of like walked off the stage. And then it was McCoy Tyner's turn. McCoy Tyner has been, a major inspiration to me because of the kind of chords he had to think up in order to leave room for somebody as wild as Coltrane. Then when McCoy Tyner got done, Workman and Garrison had this conversation, between these two basses. Then it was Elvin Jones' turn. Now, at that time, Elvin Jones was probably the most single powerful drummer there was. He unamplified in a small room like that could literally paste you against the back wall, which is what he proceeded to do. I had ingested every possible form of chemical alteration that I could lay my hands on for this event. And so I was in a somewhat susceptible state. And he drove me up out of my chair, into the aisle, back to the back wall, and finally completely all the way into the men's room. And I'm leaning against this really awful vomit green tile in the bathroom, trying to cool my fevered brow, and just come down just enough to where I could maintain. And the door to the room goes, wham! and is train. I slid down the wall. I melted in a puddle on the floor of that John. He didn't even know I was in there. He had never stopped playing his solo. He was still playing his solo, walking around the club. And he walked in there because the acoustics were good. And he was at full burn, man. Just full burn. And he just absolutely melted me in a puddle, you know. It's burned in my brain. It was such an intense experience. I can't believe it. But, Coltrane affected me very strongly. Very strongly. I remember another funny Coltrane story. It was when I was programming Africa Brass into McGuinn's head. I kept playing it and playing it and playing it because Africa Brass was one of my all-time favorites. And we were driving around in this Winnebago on a tour with Bo Diddley, the Weave Five, and Paul Revade in the Rear Doors. And we couldn't ride on the regular bus because we couldn't smoke joints on the regular bus. So we had our own little, Winnebago. And we were playing this music, and we were playing Coltrane, and we thought it was so cosmic. This will tell you exactly how blasted we were. We thought it was so cosmic, man. We pulled up to this train crossing, and we were playing Coltrane, and a whole train load of coal went across. And we all just sat there going, wow, cosmic, man.
The song that we used to sing to piss off the warden in prison because he hated it.
Oh, can I get myself together? Yeah, you can find me in that sunny southern weather. Yeah,
I'm going to find.
Had you been exposed to the beat stuff before that at all, before hearing Dylan?
Beat poetry, beat prose, beat Jack Kerouac.
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that stuff had shaped us. And some of those guys were around when the Byrds started. Allen Ginsberg used to come and dance every night.
That's because he had a big crush on you, he told me.
Allen, he's a sweetheart. He's such a wonderful guy. You can't help but love him.
Yeah.
He and Peter Orlovsky. Were there almost every night that the Byrds played, and a ton of others too, you know. And yes, I was unquestionably, you know, affected by all of those guys' writing. Who couldn't be? How could you not?
Mm-hmm. What did you get from it?
A lot of my iconoclast, outside the mainstream. Don't take the establishment point of view for being, you know, what it says it is at face value, attitude, mm-hmm. you know. A lot of my go find out for yourself, a lot of my what's on the other side of that hill,
mm-hmm.
a lot of, well, one thing for sure we know is we don't know,
mm.
you know, a sense of adventure, you know. I wanted nothing more than to go out and adventure around the country by myself with a guitar and a bag and, you know, just bop into town, find the coffee house, say, hi, hire me, I'm cheap.
Right. Yeah. Well, the nice thing about their writing is that it infused both a social criticism but a real spirituality as well. And it was a spirituality that didn't depend on religious structures or hierarchies but personal experience.
Yeah, I felt that. I felt also from them a mission. Now, you're going to think I'm really getting weird. But there was a story I used to tell. I used to tell it in the set sometimes, and I used to tell it all the time to people that I was talking to, which was the story of the dinosaur eggs. People would ask me what I was doing, you know, and I would say, well, I'm an egg thief. And they'd say, an egg thief? And I'd say, yeah, I'm an egg thief. And they'd say, what, do you have a fever, David? And I'd say, no, it goes like this. I said, once upon a time, there was the whole planet was ruled by these dinosaurs, see? And there were these little tiny furry guys that lived there too. And the dinosaurs didn't even notice them, you know? They would, like, step on one, squish, not even notice. But the little furry guys were determined to have their way about things. So they went around, and they found where the dinosaurs' eggs were. And they kept stealing the eggs until one day there weren't any more dinosaurs. And what I am doing is going out and sticking another set of ideals, another set of alternative values out there and trying to tempt the young away from the dinosaurs. Because I don't believe in what they're saying. I don't think John Wayne's right. I don't think war is glorious. I don't think, you know, that racism is right. I don't think that, you know, I mean, the civil rights thing was just starting, and it was pretty heavy. I don't think, you know, that You know, I don't see why people can't live in peace with each other. You know, I had the full hippie ethic going. And my image of myself was this little furry, sneaky guy out there stealing eggs, you know. At least luring them away from their parents, which I tried to do.
This one doesn't have words yet either, but it will probably have some soon.
David Crosby's solo demo of Wooden Ships, recorded March 28, 1968, before the song was even finished. I really want to thank David Crosby for making this special material available, and Steve Silberman for an excellent interview. Crosby's still on the mend from his liver transplant, but he said to say hi to everybody, and he hopes to be back on stage in the very near future. The name of that live album is It's All Coming Back to Me Now, and it's on Atlantic Records. And now, here are some scenes from next week's Grateful Dead Hour. This has been Grateful Dead Hour number 344. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. I'm David Gans, and I'll meet you back here next week.